today's episode, we talk about the EHCP, Education, Health and Care Plan. So, there's a few things we're going to talk about tonight on that topic. We're going to talk about the early years, and then preschool, primary school. Basically, we have reception in year one. We don't have beyond year one because our son is currently 6 years old, our eldest.
And being homeschooled.
Yeah, and we will get to that bit as well. There will be talk about the CDC, the, I believe, Child Development Centre, the local authority, doing the EHCP itself, along with gathering evidence, in which we gathered lots of evidence. Well, I didn't. You did.
I did indeed.
The obstacles you'll have along the way, including perhaps certain people of the establishment who may stop you from progressing, so therefore you have to be on guard and fight every step based on our experience. But it's worth it if you can dig out for your kid and fight their corner, you can win. In today's episode, we will be talking about the EHCP, the Education, Health and Care Plan. There are a few aspects of it we'd like to go through, and the various stages of your child's development, especially regarding the early years up to and including year one. So I'm going to go through early years, preschool, identifying certain flags, should we call it, at that point, how you can raise your concerns, in quotation, if they appear developmentally different and may require extra help, which you are entitled to under the law. We will cover interactions with the CDC, which is the Child Development Centre, their time at primary school, reception year one, the local authority gathering EHCP evidence, in which you gathered a ton to make it overwhelmingly favoured in the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
If you have to appeal decisions, some of the processes, and we can have to emphasise the importance of fighting every step of the way for getting the right needs for your child. So we're going to start off with, I'd say, from the period of which they're born to just before preschool, the really early years, probably 0 to 2. We should cover that area. So what was that of our eldest that you noticed yourself and how they're different? And also cover maybe what they're capable of as well, because we always talk about the negative aspects too much, but there are the other side of the coin where you think, wow, that's quite impressive, or they picked that up quickly, or that kind of stuff as well.
We were actually talking to our caseworker today, which we'll cover more later, and she actually said it is a shame because the model that we have to use currently is the deficit-based one, and that is because if a child is not deemed impacted enough or, you know, challenged enough, then they don't get the support. So kind of, I think that's what has been quite difficult with all the paperwork I've completed over the years, is having to read this really negative account and list of your child and all the things they can't do and all the things that are wrong with them. And actually a lot of those things, that there's nothing actually wrong with them. They're different. They're not thriving in certain environments. But because they don't fit in that environment, they're wrong. And yes, some of the behaviours that we exhibit as autistic people are different, and some, you know, can impact our lives, like the sensory issues. But actually, if we're left to get on with it or supported adequately, you find that most people thrive. And that's kind of what the problem is. And so therefore, I think that's what is also draining as a parent, completing all of this paperwork. And from day one, the people that come out to assess your child, you know, the health visitors, everybody, they come and they have forms, they have to, questionnaires you have to fill out, and then they score them, you know, on how normal or abnormal your child is. And then, you know, whether there's cause for concern. That word has triggered me so many times. And I remember saying to a professional, I can't actually get past the word concern. I'm really sorry it's triggering for me, but I can't answer your question because I'm actually fixating on the word concern, because I'm not really concerned. These things are differences, but I'm not really concerned. You know, because that's what I was asked from day one. What are your concerns? I'm not really concerned. It's just more that he's not developing typically or like his peers. He's not developing how I have witnessed other children in families or friends or through school when I was teaching. He's not developing in the same way. He's exhibiting different behaviours, I suppose. And it wasn't really a concern. They paint it as though it's this really negative thing. I've never at any point said I want him to be like the other children. It's just the fact that you can't put him into an environment with children who are different to him, because he's the one who stands out and he is not understood or supported. So I think that's the problem from my mind. I'm doing it more to protect him, whereas they're seeing it as a concern and something that needs to be fixed.
That is the point I'd like to tackle as well, is that we live in a ableist society where if you deviate from the norm, you are made to fit in and conform. And the trouble is, the people in the system, most of the time, just go, you're either going to fit into this particular box and you'll have to conform, or we'll just bundle you off to a special school. It's a very binary system. It's worse if you can't exist in either. And we cover that tonight, because our son doesn't really fit in either situation with the PDA profile, but we can tackle that as we go along.
We were asking about early days, what differences were there? It's really hard to remember. I remember at the time it being very clear, but when they asked me to go back and remember, I can't.
I remember you being able to teach him quite a few things.
Yeah, he was definitely ahead of a lot of the developmental milestones in terms of not the physical things, like walking, crawling. I mean, I don't think he was very behind, but he definitely was behind most children.
9 or 10 months?
I don't remember. It's so bad,
I swear it was about 9 or 10 months. I mean, he wasn't bad.
I've written it all down somewhere. I think it's all become a blur. To be honest with you, I think much of that is because all we've had to do since 2 is monitor, record, write. And I think everything's become a jumble. I don't feel we've been able to really enjoy their development, because everything from day 1 has been about noting concerns and providing evidence. And that is, I can think, sadly, that is what has kind of ruined, tainted
the experience of watching your child grow.
Yeah.
Because you're having to do multiple things at once, so you don't truly get to observe the moment in time and just savour it for what it is.
I try to do that as well, but I think it's why my memories are blurred.
Probably doesn't help they've got 2 boys as well.
Yeah, I do sometimes mix up who did what.
Some of it's a bit homogenous, where you're like,
was that one or that one?
I don't know. Yeah, the other point to raise as well is during this whole process, the first thing they're going to look at is your parenting.
Oh, yeah.
So if you're not careful, you could,
or confident,
you could be under the radar of examination, because they'll look at that, and they'll first thing they'll go is, right, the behavior, where's it coming from, is it bad parenting?
I felt in the early years in particular, more so than actually as he's got older, that we were under the microscope. And being a teacher who taught some children who actually were from families where there was abuse and a lot of other things that were not very nice, and those children were very affected and traumatized, I understood the value of that. I understood why they needed to do that. But I will admit, in our case, it seemed to go on for an unnecessary amount of time. Like, you know, once you've already proved that you know what you're talking about and you've given enough evidence, and then they want to send you to a parenting course that you know is absolutely pointless. And I'm very lucky. I mean, we're quite resistant people anyway. We made it quite clear that we weren't.
You have to push back. You have to be assertive.
You absolutely point blank refused to go.
I did.
I did consider it, because I thought it's something, because somebody said to me, a professional, you need to go because you need to be seen to be helping yourself. I just can't stand that. And actually my health visitor had swapped at the time, and she'd actually spent a morning with us. And it was when we had her that things started to move forward. They didn't before.
And again, that will vary based on the person in the role as well.
Absolutely. And what their experience is. And she was very understanding. And she, but she had a lot of time for us as a family, because she could see, in her words, what a good parent I was. And when they suggested parenting classes, she actually said, no, you won't be going on those. And, you know, she made it really quite clear that that was not something that should be expected of me. And she also said that because I was a teacher, there was nothing new to learn.
Yeah.
I'd already done a lot of that in my job. And also she could see from spending the amount of time she had around me, because she was very vigilant and very thorough and did not have this with the previous one. Yeah, she said, you know, this is an absolute waste of your time. And I'm really pleased I didn't have to go through that, but I know many, many do. And straight away they do attack your parenting. And they'll say they're trying to support your parenting, but I have a friend who's actually been to parenting courses and she's come back and told me about what they've done, and it's nothing really revolutionary. I also don't want to deny that some parents probably do benefit from it and some parents probably do need to go. But sadly, from my experience when I was teaching, some of the parents who were ordered or asked to go to parenting classes would not go. And actually, some of the people who probably would benefit refused. And so the system is crazy because they're trying to send people like us to it when it's really clear that the problems in our family are due to us being neurodivergent and just different. And I don't even like the word problems, but of course you're conditioned to use these words about yourself: disordered, weird, different. Disordered, weird. I can't even think what the other word was that I said. You know, it's awful. It's ingrained from day one. When you actually refer to yourself and your children in these negative terms, because that's the vocabulary that is constantly used by professionals, by everybody around you, and by every piece of literature you come across, it's hard not to slip up and do it, even though I know better. Because sadly, when you're having to write everything out, there's a system in place, there are procedures to follow. And even if you challenge the language, they will still revert to the language that they believe should be applied.
The ableist language, for example, the word disorder really does piss me off.
Yeah.
I'd rather use the word condition, because our brain is wired to a certain state or a certain condition of wiring. Whatever you want to put it, it's just wired differently. But no, we have to throw disorder on it. And my brain doesn't feel disordered. Maybe the sensory aspects can be a bit extreme and certain other things. But in general, I don't feel disordered.
No.
I feel normal. My normal.
Yeah. I do. I mean, I have moments. Like I said to you, we're watching...
You can be overwhelmed.
I'm watching this series called The Bold Type on Netflix at the moment. And I said to you, I don't know if this is a normal thing. And again, it's that word normal, isn't it? I don't know if everybody would do this. I imagine they don't. But one of the characters is called Jacqueline. And I said to you, didn't I? Every time they say Jacqueline, which is quite a lot in the show because she's the editor, I see the word and I keep going over the word in my mind. And I spell the word. I think of the letters. I then mouth it very gently. It's really strange, you know, strange to other people, but these are little things that kind of bring me comfort. So, and I'll be sat there going, Jacqueline, Jacqueline. And even if I'm not saying it out loud, it will be in my head. I'll be going over and over, repeating this name and thinking about all the letters in it and how it's spelt. And for some reason, it's a word or a name that fascinates me. And every time they say it, I have the same process. I don't imagine that's everybody's experience.
I can confirm that's not what happens in my head right now.
Well, precisely, and you're autistic and I'm autistic and we're all different. And
we
I
are.
Think, you know, but that's not the question you asked me. Really briefly, I did notice things that were different with him developmentally. Obviously, he was delayed in some areas. He wasn't ridiculously behind, was he? But he was delayed in some areas. But what we noticed was a lot of his gross motor things were delayed, and he still is delayed. He's 6 years old. He still can't pedal a bike. He's only just learned recently to jump and catch and throw, and that was with a lot of intense input from me, doing a lot of other activities to try and kind of build those muscles and build those skills and, you know, that kind of thing.
Muscle memory.
And again, I put that down to my teaching to a point as well, because I used to teach those lessons, and I used to obviously have children who were dyspraxic and had other issues, and had to find ways. So it might just be using a bigger ball or standing closer together and just making sure that they place their hands a certain way. It's that kind of thing. It's just, you know, adapting. And I think that's all we need to do with people to help them thrive, really. But it seems to be too much for some. But what I did find with him was that when he was very young, and this is where people say, no, he can't be autistic. He was actually, like, amazing. He was so happy and placid.
Yeah.
And well-behaved. We could go out for a coffee. And I'm not saying you should do this with young children, but you could. You could go for a coffee and you could take toys and things to stimulate him, and he'd be happy just sat there in a high chair.
He
for
would,
a long
actually.
Stretch of time, just having his little snacks and doing the same thing over and over, really. And people would compliment me on how well-behaved he was. Obviously, as he's got older and he's now struggling with these same things, I don't put the same demand on him because he can't tolerate it. And there's a big difference. But when he was very small, and I mean literally from baby to probably 2.5.
Yeah.
He was able, and he seemed quite happy. You know, the things I did were not too... I don't know how to explain it, really, because I think people are going to go, oh, that's awful that you made him do that. It was just like your typical things that you would do as a parent or a teacher. But he responded to it and he was happy and I was happy. I remember being complimented that once he went running off ahead of me, again, not too far because I didn't allow that. But we were on a playground or something somewhere, and he went running off and I was like, freeze, stop. And he stopped immediately, and my friend's boy didn't. And, you know, he's ADHD, actually. But he, from very young, could not follow instructions whatsoever. You know who I'm talking about, don't you?
I do, yeah.
And my friend used to be like, oh, my gosh, you know, your son is so good. He listens so well. It appeared that he did. Yeah, absolutely. And this is where people say, well, that doesn't make sense. Because he did, you know, he was obedient. He did as he was told. He could follow instructions. I feel like that early part of his life was just very much... I don't really know how to explain it. He was just really placid and happy to kind of live in the bubble of just me and him pretty much most of the time. And it was me and him most of the time. He had a lot of one-to-one input from me, and he was happy. Like, people would say, oh, you don't take him out enough. But he was happy to sit indoors and play with toys. The same things over and over again, building towers, knocking them down. And also... I did a lot of educational play with him, and he needed that stimulation. Like, he really enjoyed doing the one-to-one, to the point that I think it was 16 months. I have a video of him between 16 and 18 months solving a shape puzzle. And it was just 2D shapes, like flower, diamond, heart, square, rectangle, that kind of thing, hexagon. And he could, I would say what they were, and he could pick up the correct shape and put it into the correct place in the puzzle. And for me, I wasn't really aware of what other children could do. He was my first. I'd never had any experience of that age group. So for me, it was typical he could do these things. By the age of 2, he knew all of his phonics. He knew all the actions that corresponded to the sounds. And he also knew numbers up to quite a high number, didn't he?
Yeah.
So, you know, but again, he could regurgitate a lot of information. And we then started to realise as he got older that a lot of it was regurgitation. So he's got a really good memory and he could remember like scripts that you taught him, but he didn't have the kind of independent thought.
Yeah.
This is probably worded terribly, but if we gave him a script, for example, of how to introduce himself or talk to people, and again, I'm not doing it in the kind of ABA style, it was more... just teaching him language, vocabulary, that kind of thing. I'm really big on, you know, that with children. I'm a huge fan of Pye Corbett Taught for Writing. And he always says, how can you ask children to write if they have nothing to write about? There are a lot of children who are not read to. They're not given the language. So for me, from very early on, I've always been a huge believer in that. And the scripts were not consciously done. I think I just naturally realised that he was unable to kind of converse or discuss with people independently, and it was just to help him know what to say and how to socialize and that kind of thing. And again, I know some people will criticize that, but you know, this is what you do for your children, especially if he's there making funny noises at a child at a soft play, that you've just had all these children around you and you're trying to get them to play with your child, and then he starts poking his tongue out making noises and they are put off and they run away and he cries. Of course, you're going to try and teach your child how to interact. And again, people will say, well, that's wrong because you're trying to make him something he's not. And it's not that at all. But at the end of the day, we do also need to teach some element of social skill so that he can be successful in some of these interactions, because the failed interactions are what are shaping his negative
worldview.
Yeah, really.
The thing about it is you have to get anywhere in life, unless you're self-made super genius who've managed to just do well by themselves, and all the wealth and accolade that goes with it. Well done. But that's a rarity. 99% of the time, it requires mutual cooperation and benefit to get anywhere. You can't normally do it alone. So there's a certain level of human interaction and coexistence to get by because of just the way it is. And the thing about people on the spectrum is traditionally they don't pick up the unwritten rules, the social osmosis.
They have to be explicitly taught.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's a mechanical thing that has to be taught to them.
Yeah. And the thing is, you get a lot of abuse from... I think the problem is now we're in a really difficult time because there's a lot of abuse out there about ABA and people misunderstand what that actually is. Like, my understanding of ABA is the applied behavior analysis, I think that is when you are trying to make somebody not themselves. Like, we'll go over this more later, but there are targets that are given to our children that are designed to make them more neurotypical, is to make them less autistic. That was never my intention.
No.
It's more to help him thrive in situations where he wants to be involved, he just doesn't quite know how to access it. But I would never be forcing him into situations he was uncomfortable with. For example, he's not really around a lot of children now and people keep saying it's terrible, but actually I don't want him around other children because it's always a failure. He's very sociable where he likes to chat with kids, but he's also very controlling and he doesn't really know how to act around them. He doesn't cope with them having their own ideas about what they want to play and say and that kind of thing. And people say, well, he has to learn. And I'm like, well, he will learn. But at the moment, he is not in that space. And so the safest and the most secure thing for him at the moment is to be in his own space safely with me. And we will create opportunities in different ways. We've started doing it online and we'll find different ways to give him those experiences. But people go, no, 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 he must be around children his own age. He must, you know, be around normal children. And I just think it's I think that's actually what's more ableist, is to put him around children who don't understand him, who aren't really very kind to him because they find him strange and peculiar, when actually a lot of the things he does, they're not really. Actually, there are reasons behind a lot of his behavior. It's just never explained to people and he's not accepted for who he is,
and he'll be rejected, and then rejected. He'll feel that and
he fails and
gets upset and he'll cry.
People don't see the fallout, we do, and we're not putting him through it. He doesn't need to go through it, and people argue with us and say, well,
I refuse to conform.
Yeah,
I'm a non-conformist.
Right. we might find at some point he's able, but he's not at the moment, and I'm not putting him in that situation.
It's early days, and in other cultures they're not expected to at that age either. I think that's the other thing, we're too stuck in our Victorian ways of,
yeah,
kids must go to school at this age, they must attend for this period of time.
And they must sit still and they must look at a board.
Pay attention.
And, you know, they do not fidget, they do not talk. It's just crazy.
Robots.
It really is crazy. You know, as a teacher, I know there's an element of frustration when you're trying to teach a lesson.
Crowd control.
And the children are, you know, you do have to have an element of it in place, because if it was a free-for-all, then yeah, you're not going to achieve anything. But yeah, I think there's a big difference between that, which is reasonable, and what some teachers try to do with children. And that is, if they're like my child, who doesn't fit into the box neatly and is going to be disruptive, they just don't really want to have to deal with that. And that's kind of what I feel like. Again, we can explain this more. But, you know, in summary, the very early years, we did notice he was a bit different with some of his developmental milestones, and also academically, like how able he appeared. He seemed so articulate when he was talking, but we started to realise very quickly it was scripted. It was what he'd learned to say on repeat. And yes, if anybody came away from that script, he would go back to the beginning and repeat it, or just completely freeze, or make funny noises at people.
Yeah, he would. And I think that wraps that period of time. I would then decide, yes, I think we need to move on to preschool scenario, that environment.
Okay, well, really briefly on this one, even though there's so much I could say about this, and I just want to say that the preschool he attended, we actually looked at one That was really awesome.
Had all the gear, but no idea.
Yeah, basically. And he actually, that was one of the first times we experienced a true meltdown. Like, we'd had some, but this was probably the worst we'd seen at this point.
Yes, the day of the viewing.
He must have been 2 and a bit or 3 at this point, because we didn't send him to preschool till about 3 and a half. I think that's right. He was at least 3 anyway.
And we waited a bit, didn't we?
We were getting such hassle. Oh, he needs to be at preschool, blah, blah, blah. And I said, he's not ready. And people were saying, no, you're not ready.
Yeah.
And that's all I've had all along. And it's just awful.
Oh, that's a quick side note. Every step of the way, you will have unhelpful comments with people that don't have a fucking clue.
Yep. And then they put it on you all the time as the parent. And so that's awful, because you get it from everywhere. You know, you're dealing with your own stuff in the family and with your children. And then you get the external crap. And it's really hard.
Tune them out, because...
I still can't.
You are the expert in your own child.
But you're right. You are the expert in your own child.
Remember that.
But we took him to this really awesome preschool. And they actually gave him... Was it a blue train or something to hold when he was there?
I swear it was a train.
And he was really into blue at the time, if you remember. Really obsessed with blue.
Favourite colour.
And... But he did not understand that this had to be returned. And I don't really feel this was clearly... explained to him either. And we viewed the place and he loved it, but then we went into this room and they said, oh, he can interact with the children, that's fine. So he sat down on the carpet, put the train down to get something, and of course inevitably another child started playing with the train, and that was it. That is where the meltdown began. And
yes,
I don't remember if they gave the blue train back to him or not. I don't think they did, but they could not usher us out of that environment, that setting, quickly enough. And we knew straight away we weren't going to be accepted have a place there.
It was quite amusing. Suddenly there was no space available, despite having us visit the school.
Yeah, and also the whole attitude towards us when he acted like that. And it just came across that he was like this spoiled brat. And actually, you could see there was more going on. And he'd fixated on this toy.
I
think this is the problem for families outside of neurodivergent families. You know, I am so big on teaching manners, politeness, sharing, all of those skills. But there is a point when you have to sometimes acknowledge, like Dr. Ross Green says in The Explosive Child, that some children have not developed certain skill sets, and we need to work on filling these gaps before they're able to access these things. And people don't seem to realise that that can also involve those skills. And instead, you just have a brat who's just pushing boundaries and trying to get away with everything and wrapping you around their little finger. And you're just pandering as a parent and making them into a bad child. And it's really tough, because you can see with him that it goes beyond him making a choice to be a brat or to not share. It is literally, he cannot look past the fixation. And even now we have elements of that with both children at 4 and 6, and people don't understand. So anyway, obviously we didn't get a place at that preschool, but we actually looked elsewhere before. We didn't feel it was the right setting for him after what had happened.
No.
And then we found one that, admittedly, it was literally a hall, wasn't it? Where they kind of put things out and then pack it away.
It was a scout hall.
Yeah. And I went to something like that when I was small and loved it. But because it wasn't all singing and dancing like this other place, which is, you know, deemed as this outstanding, wonderful setting where all children will thrive, we were a little bit worried and feeling like, oh, you know, we want the best for him. But we went in, and as soon as we went in, outside we were like, oh, not sure if it looks quite right. There isn't the same access to outside space. They don't have the same facilities. But as soon as we went in and felt the warmth in that environment.
Brilliant.
We were like, this is what we need for him. And it doesn't matter about anything else. It's the nurture. It's the understanding. It's the compassion. And that is what he got from the moment he walked into that setting. And he thrived there. He thrived in terms of the staff went above and beyond and they loved him. And they tried to adapt everything for him. And he did have he had a lot of moments there. But they created safe spaces for him. They allowed him to go and run off if he needed to. They did buddy systems. They just did so much for him, even without us asking. But we did work together very closely with them. But one thing that was notable is when we viewed the place, he did stand in the corner and kind of like try and work the place out. But he didn't play with other children. He played alongside them. He was often on his own. And he would fixate on particular toys. And what the preschool were great at was realizing that he's not in a space to be able to share this. Like, if they had a day with him where he was a little bit more tolerant or able to access that, they could push those skills.
Yep.
But they only did it when they felt he was secure to do it. And I think that that is where we were so lucky he was there, because a lot of places don't do that. They say, no, you must share this toy now because so-and-so wants this toy. And actually they could see with him, it was beyond him just not wanting to share. He'd fixated on this item. This was his comfort. And so you couldn't take this item away from him. The preschool, again, there's so much I could go into at this place, and they were awesome. Maybe we should do something just about them, to be honest, at some point.
Yeah, they're that good.
They were amazing. But actually, they tried to apply for an HCP because they could see how troubled he was, and they said he is going to struggle at school. He needs one before he goes. So the manager had 1 week to meet the deadline for the HCP request, and was actually told by the area Senko at the time that it would not be supported. And essentially he'd have to go to school in a sink or swim fashion, and the school would have to complete one if they felt, after getting eyes on him, that he needed one. We were then advised to apply for one on our own through Sendai Us, which we started. And then the school that he was at obviously very quickly noticed that he needed more help and said they would take it over. Long story short, COVID and so many other factors contributed to this not happening. And then last year, at the end of 2020, about 6 weeks before Christmas,
yep.
I did it myself. And it's a process. I mean, I've been informed today they've changed the forms, which is probably for the best because they were inaccessible, quite frankly.
As if they were designed that way on purpose, perhaps.
It feels like it, doesn't it? I think this is the problem. We so often think, is this done on purpose so that people can't get past this barrier? Is it because they want to make sure that they're not, you know, having to spend money and help these families? It's just bizarre to me, really. I don't know why you would make everything so hard. But apparently they've changed. I've just not seen what they've changed to yet. But it was quite epic, a task. And yeah, it's so basically from start to finish, it's taken years. It took, so when did we get that issued? Just before, no, we've only had it issued after his 6th birthday, haven't we? So
yeah,
he was flagged up at 2, properly referred to paediatricians at 3, obviously started preschool. We were actually advised to put him in preschool to get more eyes on him. I didn't feel that he was ready for school, especially without the HCP. But again, I was told, no, he must go to school. We need to see him struggle. The whole system seems to be about seeing them struggle, and they don't actually take it very seriously about the trauma this causes for the child.
And also, if that is the case, how long is he supposed to struggle for before it takes a toll? They never, ever consider that aspect.
And they also don't consider the aspect of those children who mask.
Yeah.
Those children who aren't, like, as obvious as him, that mask at school and come home, like our youngest.
Oh, wow, yeah.
He masks outside of the house or at school, but he comes home and he's explosive, and you can just see he's just really wound up from holding everything in all day. And people then think that's just a parenting issue. And actually, you know, I think when he's at school, he's going to be more obvious because he'll be there 5 days a week and he won't be able to hide it all the time. And I think he'll be like you were at school, where he'll plod along and then explode.
Yeah.
And the problem is you're not taken seriously as parents. And for children like him, it's even harder to get the support because people don't see it. And it's so frustrating. And this is where knowledge about autism or neurodivergence and any SEND really needs to be expanded. We just need better training all around.
100%.
Too many people are being let down. Too many children, too many families. And we're really fed up with it, to be honest. Not just for us, for every family.
So before we get into primary school, I think we should briefly talk about the Child Development Centre and the fun and games with them.
Okay, so we were referred to a paediatrician when he was 2.5, 3. And we saw somebody when he was about 3.5. And this particular paediatrician said, look, it's too early for me to say he definitely has autism or is ASD, as they worded it. But you are definitely barking up the right tree. She said, when he first came into the room, he made a bit of eye contact and seemed quite articulate, and I wasn't sure. That old chestnut.
Brilliant.
And she said, but the longer you've been here, because it was quite a long appointment, it was like an initial one, so it was a long one, and I took my mum with me so that I had somebody to occupy him, and so we could talk, and also to get her kind of view on things. And sometimes they dismiss you as a parent, but they seem to not dismiss the grandparents as much. I'm not really sure why that is. You know, especially when you're a first-time parent, they love to lay the boot in. Oh, yes, you're a first-time parent. What do you know?
So the tip there is, first-time parent, do not go into this alone. Have someone else to back you up.
Any parent, just take someone else to back you up, really, and have notes. And it's just tiring. And people do not comprehend how draining this whole system is. But she said, you're definitely barking up the right tree. But although I can't say here and now, yes, he has ASD, there is definitely a case for SPD. You can see very clearly that his sensory needs are quite prominent. And that was literally from this one appointment. We were then referred to SALT, so speech and language. And she confirmed that he was average for his speech and language. But she did notice that he was quite repetitive, scripted. And also she was doing these activities with him, such as, oh, can you show me where the... I can't remember any of the things she did, but can you see where she is? And then he'd have to point at like the girl, that kind of thing. And at the end of the session, she was trying to talk to us and he actually got the book and then said, now, can you show me where she is? And started like mimicking everything and going through all the pictures. And she said that was really interesting because again, it's this mimicking and that's how he learns. So it's not always just about scripting everything.
It's a learning style.
It's the fact that he literally, his scripts are not always things I've necessarily explicitly taught him. It's things he picks up, but he doesn't always have any understanding outside of that part of it, if that makes sense. And she said there was a real clear, evidence of the fact that he was quite scripted and his attention span wasn't great. And she straight away again, and she said to us, you know, the system is this, it's a process. But we then told her what the other paediatrician had said. And she said, I am in total agreement. And again, although I'm not allowed to just give you a diagnosis here today,
yep,
my job is to determine whether we continue with this process. And I'm 100% suggesting that we do, because it is my opinion that he is autistic. You know, so we've got two off the record professionals telling us, you know, he's autistic, but we're not allowed to diagnose that officially just yet. But he's autistic and it's obvious. And I think what's really hard for me is that from the age of two or three, it's been obvious to everybody that he's autistic. And then the paediatrician sadly went on long-term sick and we got referred to another one. And her approach was very much let's watch and wait. So I think we did two appointments over the course of a year or 2 years with that person.
What, two 15-minute appointments, perhaps?
They were short appointments, and it was literally just us telling them something, and then they might interact with him, with our child for a while. And, oh, look, he spoke to me. He made a bit of eye contact.
Whoop-de-doo.
And, you know, and I think this is the problem. Just because you can speak a little bit and make a bit of eye contact and engage to a point doesn't mean you're not autistic. That's where I get really agitated with this out-of-date stereotypical view of autism.
I mean, that consultant was in her advanced years, so it's quite clear that, I don't know, some of the original training is still...
When I mentioned PDA,
still there.
They did not know what that was.
And that's a warning sign there. That really is, because the minute they can't tell you what PDA is, and if your kid is PDA, you're in for a world of pain.
To their credit, though, they did go and research it because we've since had conversations about it over the telephone. However, it's still this watch and wait approach. And the only reason that my eldest wound up being referred to the CDC, which we thought he was already on a waiting list for,
yep,
because that's what we'd been told, is because this person also went off on sickness. And then we were contacted by somebody at the hospital who reviewed everything, spoke to me for a long time, and then said, well, he needs a referral.
And we were bamboozled by that.
Yeah, and that was done. And I said, oh, I thought one had already been made.
Yeah.
I thought we were just on a waiting list. Oh, no, no, you know. And then that appointment happened, and that was actually with a consultant at the Child Development Centre. And again, you know, it sounds like you're just criticizing everybody. We've acknowledged there's red tape. We've acknowledged there are targets. There will be internal issues that we are not aware of working in that system.
Admin.
But it is also true and fair to say that some of the professionals, and I always use inverted commas for this, some of the professionals we've come across have not actually had any knowledge of the things that we've thrown at them and asked them questions about. And instead, what they like to do is then try and dismiss you.
And assert their authority.
And trivialise you and patronise you. And you feel like you and your child are being punished. And it's really not okay.
Like they're going to make an example of you because you dare question them.
And the thing is with me being autistic myself is...
The need to seek clarity and confirmation.
Because sometimes I find it hard to process and sometimes I find it hard to read what they're actually saying or thinking because of their body language. And one person we saw made me feel so uncomfortable that I actually lost the ability to speak. And as you know, I'm a talker and I actually lost the ability to speak. I did not know what to say.
That's rare.
I was so shocked by the things that were coming out of this person's mouth. I had a whole folder of evidence that they did not want to see. They were not interested. And they tried to usher me out of the room while I was talking. When I did get my words back. When I wanted to challenge something. You know, and this has been our experience. So, again, I don't want to kind of tarnish the people out there who are doing good and who this does not apply to, but in our experience, we've met too many that do fit into this category. And you just wonder why, A, they're in the job, and B, how they have the authority to be making big decisions about our children.
The issue I have is there seems to be this whole thing where you just come against these box-ticking neurotypicals who don't really know. Because they haven't experienced it firsthand themselves.
Yeah, they say things that are just wrong.
It just breaks you because you think, you don't know what you're talking about.
But they talk to you like you're over-exaggerating.
And you're like, no, I experience it. I feel it firsthand and I've experienced it via my kid as well.
And then they try and make out that you're just trying to put stuff on your kid. And like, why would... And again, why I know that some parents...
do that?
I've been told... Well, you know, don't take it personally because some parents are like that. I'm sure some are, but I think the majority are not. And I think some parents get labelled wrongly, especially if you're a neurodivergent parent. What I've actually said to you disturbs me is I've challenged things they've tried to do. I've challenged things they've tried to diagnose and things they've tried to say. Because I've known better. Or yeah. I've got research I can throw back at them to challenge their
they hate
idea.
That.
And the thing is, again, it makes me sound so confrontational, but I spent years nodding my head and being polite until somebody off the record told me that that was why we weren't getting anywhere, because as far as they were concerned, I was coping too well and we weren't in need.
You need to be a pain in the ass to them.
But it's awful, really, isn't it? And the way I saw it was actually there will be some families that need it more than we do. So no, I'm happy to step back and let them get the support. But actually, it's not right because although I'm coping to a point, it's taken its toll in so many ways. And at the end of the day, he should never have been put in a position of being put into a mainstream school without an EHCP in the first place.
Correct.
It's just insane. But one thing that I always challenge, and I want to make this clear here, and I've written about it, but I want to make it clear, okay, is they are too quick to diagnose ADHD, and that is what happened in our case. Oh, it's just ADHD. They saw him for 10 minutes. He was very heightened, very hyperactive. I completely understand why they felt he exhibited ADHD symptoms, and he is definitely, I'd said previous to this appointment, I do believe that he's not just autistic. I believe that he's dually autistic and has ADHD, along with a few other issues, and his sensory world is very, very different. To most people, I'd say that's probably the thing that causes him the most issues.
Yes.
It's very obvious that that's what is going on. And for professionals not to be able to understand the huge ordeal of having to leave the house, get to an appointment, go into a waiting room, be called into a consultation room, have their blood pressure taken, all these other things, and to feel that that's not going to have an effect on a child who has these sensory issues, and then just, you know... quite lazily really go, oh, they're just ADHD, we're going to medicate them in 10 minutes of seeing the child, it's just irresponsible. And that was what my response was. And what I want to make really clear is children who have ADHD symptoms sometimes appear to have ADHD when actually they might have sensory processing difficulties. They might have both. But you need to investigate it before you medicate. It is irresponsible to just chuck a label on a child and treat that one thing without exploring it more thoroughly. And I find so many people I've spoken to, that's what's happened. Oh yes, my daughter's been diagnosed with ADHD and medicated. Oh yes, my son's been diagnosed with ADHD and medicated. I'm not saying they don't have ADHD, and I'm not saying in some cases medication can't help. But actually, it's irresponsible to throw medication at a child when you have not explored every part of that child. And in our case, that's exactly what we've done. We fought it and said, no, we're not having him medicated, because the studies I've read have very clearly stated that if you have a dual diagnosis of autism and ADHD, meds can actually give you more side effects or just not be effective whatsoever. And of course, it's not going to help the autistic part of yourself, if that makes sense.
No.
So, you know, and with sensory processing difficulties, you can actually have such huge success just by using sensory integration or a sensory lifestyle. So again, why are we medicating? Why is that our go-to?
And it should be the last resort.
It really should. And that was my argument. And admittedly, in our case, that's what's happened. They have not issued that. They have not pursued that with us.
They know.
I've spoken to so many families.
We won't accept it.
We won't.
We won't.
Initially, I had the attitude of, it's just me wanting there to be more with him. I was wrong in what I believed was different about him. You know, my diagnosis, because I'm not a professional at the end of the day. And, you know, I was actually told, you need to consider it. You need to consider the meds because it will help him. It will help you. And I was kind of made to feel that I wasn't really trying to help my child when actually I'm looking out for him. And it disturbs me how many families have probably put their children on meds at the, you know, from the advice of these so-called professionals, when actually it really was probably the wrong course of action to take.
As well as that, I'm sorry, but how the hell can you start medicating him after 15 minutes of meeting him?
Again, I just don't understand. It was a 10-minute... I mean, the appointment was longer, but he was in there for 10 minutes because he couldn't cope, and I had to send him out into the waiting room where my mum was.
It's just not far enough. The thing...
It's lazy.
What really, really grinds me is the fact that you wait probably 6 months for an appointment, for it to be such a colossal waste of time.
It is.
For what short period of time you have with them.
And then they just say, we'll watch and wait, we'll watch and wait. And you have another couple of years of that.
That could
normally
go on for years. It really can. And you just got to kick back against it and just start being more vocal.
And then you get people going, oh, well, the average age of being diagnosed is 7 or 8, isn't it? Well, it shouldn't be if it's that clear, should it really?
It's not a target.
No. And then we had a paediatrician say to us, well, we want to make sure, look at my child. It's just insane.
How much more confirmation do you require?
Exactly. I've actually read of cases where they've diagnosed children later on, like taken away the diagnosis because they're coping too well now. It's just ridiculous. If you're autistic, you're autistic. And then they say, well, we think we've made the wrong diagnosis.
You don't get cured.
Oh, it's just crazy. I just don't understand this world. I don't understand it. And it shouldn't be neurotypicals leading this work, in my opinion. You know, it really shouldn't.
Well, contrary to popular, we neurodivergents are able to hold down professional jobs. So we can quite easily populate that field and serve our own quite happily.
I think that is probably what should happen. And people go, oh, well, that's being, you know, what's the word? I can't even think of the word. I'm losing all my words again today. That's exclusive.
Okay, yeah. Well, I think you find it, if I was the race and equalities minister, as a Caucasian male, that what the hell do I know about being a minority? At the same time, if I was a heterosexual deciding to be the chairman of some kind of lesbian society, what's the point? There's no insight. It's not a best fit. You don't know how best to serve that community because you're not actually from that community.
And that's precisely it. And it's just really frustrating, isn't it?
Was it Nothing About Us Without Us or something?
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, it's completely that.
But it's just, I said in something I wrote earlier that the problem is with a lot of the language surrounding neurodivergence, they use such negative language and a list of deficits to describe us, and that's how we're viewed in the mainstream, every single one of us. And I know that, like, people go, well, there are some people who fit those, you know, those categories. Yeah, of course. Even in the neurotypical world, you have people who fit those categories. You know, not every single person who has a difficulty in life is necessarily autistic.
Oh, well, oh, a little bit autistic.
Oh, just fuck, don't right even. Off. Oh, my God.
I will hit you. I will punch you in the throat.
But we're dehumanised. That's what they do.
Yeah.
They dehumanise us by using this language.
Autism awareness. Oh, pat. Oh, I know an autistic person. Oh, virtue signalling, tosspot. Nah.
I think that needs its own post.
Oh, yeah, we really could.
Virtue signalling. Ugh, bleh, makes me sick. Oh,
God, just no. So we covered that. What else is on this piece of paper? So we've dealt with, in quotation, the professionals. Oh, God.
Why have I had to send an 18-page document detailing things, sharing studies, disputing things?
Diagrams, too.
Diagrams, cross-referencing... Croft?
Croft?
New word.
Or crufts? Cross. Talk show. Sorry.
Oh, pedigree. Cross...
Pedigreeorti.
My word.
What a fine specimen that is. What a lovely breed you have there.
To be honest with you, that's how I feel like we're treated.
Yeah, she put him on the leash. So make him jump through stuff. Do some fucking dog tricks.
Doesn't look autistic, this one.
Well, it's okay. He can play autistic if you want.
We're dehumanized, essentially.
Well, that's the thing. You're debased to some kind of stereotype. And the trouble is, if you don't fit that stereotype, you cannot possibly be that thing.
Yep, you don't look autistic. Yeah, but you have a... And I've said so many times when I've outed myself...
You don't look like a complete prick, do you? But then you opened your mouth.
You clearly are, yes. Ah, you're a prick.
So, shut the fuck up.
Pricktistic.
This is the thing that everyone's got an opinion. You're like... You're not qualified to have an opinion on something you don't know about, but instead you peddle something rather than going, I don't actually know. There's no harm in not knowing something.
Can I tell you what one of the parents said to me once when I said about our child being autistic?
Yeah.
And again, it wasn't something I volunteered.
Didn't they look concerned, didn't they? They look gutted for me.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Are you sure? No. Oh. And then when they realised he really was, they're like, oh dear, oh, I'm so sorry.
No, don't be sorry. Like, we're not.
No, I'm not sorry. I'm just explaining, you know, why he's struggling.
Yeah.
I'm just explaining why he stood there headbutting me right now.
Yeah.
You know.
That's normal for us. And it's fine.
I'm just explaining that while I'm trying to talk to you and he's licking my face, that this is why.
This is an expected behaviour based on his neurotype.
What's absolutely hilarious is on the one hand, he'd be like, oh, hello, good morning. My name is, how are you today? What a lovely day. And then I'm like, oh, no, he can't be autistic. He's so articulate. He's so polite.
That scripted little robot then, mode, though.
And then he licks my face, headbutts me, makes noises. And they're like, okay, maybe he is different. Maybe he is.
Yeah, give it time and he will come out, won't he?
That's the thing. And I think it's, you know, it's crazy. But actually, not all autistic people do that either. Our youngest doesn't present, obviously, whatsoever outside of this house. And he is very clearly autistic as well, but he just presents very differently. And I just don't know what kind of box they want everyone to fit into. It's crazy.
I mean, he deserves his own podcast episode.
He will have one.
Oh, wow. Yeah, let's...
He is not as complex in certain ways. I'd say the volume of needs of, you know, that kind of thing. Our eldest is complex and like pretty much on those comorbidity flowers. Like he fits pretty much everything on
there.
He's
the whole field.
His world is different and we feel very protective over him. He's very vulnerable.
He's such a beautiful creature.
Oh,
as well.
God, he is.
He's awesome. You
know, oh, he really is. Gosh, you know. But even his little brother's protective over him.
Yep.
There's a vulnerability there. And I think people prey on that, sadly, and it's awful.
And I just want to kick their face in.
Yeah, it worries me. It worries me going forward for him. I am worried about his future. I really am. you know, that's why we do all this.
Exactly. Fight the good fight.
Our youngest comes across just so much. He can plod along, can't he, and just be the most angelic child.
Yeah, you wouldn't know.
But there's also this other side of him, and it's like they say it's the Jekyll and Hyde. That is him. It's just him.
Explosivo.
I can't even... He does need his own podcast.
He's a little landmine.
But he is a masker. He's very super intelligent.
He's also Batman.
Super masker. Constantly Batman. Uses the Batman character to get out of anything.
Oh, he's great.
You know, to reason things with you, to negotiate with you.
When he enters Batman mode, that means he can beat the crap out of you.
But he's so clever. He's so smart.
He is.
But, you know, he does have high anxiety.
He's not stupid. You can't bluff him on anything. He will pick fault in everything.
And he takes everything in. And he does. We were having a debate the other day about who would win out of Batman and Elsa. And some of his logical arguments about why Batman would win, I wish I could remember them.
He's correct,
astounding.
Though. Batman would win.
I disagree with you. I think Elsa would win. She'd just freeze him.
Nah.
She'd freeze him.
She wouldn't see Batman coming.
So that's what he said.
He's correct. He's mastered dark stealth ninja techniques.
And then he said, well, you know, then you'd have the Joker and somebody would distract her. And then he would, because he'd get someone to distract her.
Or some kind of team up with the Joker.
Yeah, I think that's what he was
getting. This isn't a post-apocalyptic world right now.
He also said about because he's got the Batmobile and he can kind of sneak up and that kind of thing.
Hmm.
I was like, okay. And he came up with some great ideas. I just can't remember them all, sadly. I'm not as intelligent as him. It's the truth.
He's put a lot of thought into this. Rationale though.
We had a great discussion and then I think I needed to go for a wee and he was like, are you definitely coming back to finish our talk after your wee?
I'm
like, yes, don't worry, I'm coming back.
Deep stuff.
He did. He wanted to go into that deeply. But again, he's amazing. I am so like in awe of both our children for different reasons.
Yeah.
But my word, they are different, but they're both on the spectrum. And I think this is what people can't get their head around, because now we had a lot of opposition about our eldest. Oh, he's not autistic. And now people have acknowledged he is. They knew all along, of course, now.
They've rewritten history. They're in the Ministry of
so
Truth
many people
out of
rewrite
the novel
history.
1984.
It's crazy. I think people just can't acknowledge that they've given you a hard time and that they didn't actually see something that is so now glaringly obvious.
I'd rather them to say, sorry, we were wrong.
Sorry, we gave
instead
you
instead of pretending
hassle.
That they're there all along, you're like, fuck off.
No, they've given us shit, to be honest with you. You know, that's the stuff that wears you down.
Shut the fuck up. You don't get to rewrite history. We remember because ignorant words, we do actually pick up on.
And they struck a chord.
They resonate deeply.
Created a feeling, you know. So, felt alone. There were a lot of tears shed over the years and annoyance. So, but our youngest, as I said, he's a super masker. And... not everybody will see it.
Well,
and that's harder.
Oh, that's such a pain in the ass.
We've got to go through it all again with him.
Yeah, but that's fine. We'll tackle that another point. So just to keep on track.
Okay.
Okay, because, you know, we've been on for a while.
I know. How long?
About 1 hour and 4. I mean, some of that was
some of that will
around.
Be coming out.
Yeah. Some brutal cuts.
Brutal.
So you cover the fact that your evidence against the CDC was about 18 pages of...
There's been more than that even, to be honest with you, because it's been... I think I went through PALs.
Big enough to create a book out of it.
I found contacts to forward things to.
Yeah.
And I sent letters and I've just sent evidence. And I literally challenge everything. I've become that parent. And that was not an easy thing for me to become. I now feel a bit embarrassed, if I'm honest with you, because I feel like people just think... I'm this little whippet or this confrontational person, but an aggressive, hostile person, and I'm not, but
you are fighting a war for your children's future.
Yeah, it's poop.
As stated. Now, poop. So we've done that. Primary school.
Primary school was never great. From starting there, and this is really funny. So I knew he wasn't ready to go, and I kept saying it, and everyone was like, "Oh no, he was doing so good."
He'll be fine.
And the first few weeks he was there, he quite enjoyed it, and I think he transitioned in, didn't he? He transitioned in slowly, or he went in. He didn't start with everyone.
Wasn't it like 2 weeks later?
Didn't start with everyone because we moved house. Yes. We didn't have a place.
We didn't actually have a school place.
That's right. Oh, that's another discussion. Oh,
we could play about school lottery and stuff.
And also viewing schools and realising how shockingly appalling the SEND provision in a lot of these schools actually was.
Yes.
We went to a school that was outstanding and everybody recommended. And it was slightly out of our catchment, but it was our preference on paper. And when we viewed it, we just, again, like the preschool, we weren't taken with it. We thought that the resources were great. We thought the grounds were wonderful and could see lots of places for him to run and hide in when he left the classroom.
Having done that myself as a kid.
And he used to do it in preschool.
Yeah, I went missing once.
And I remember you saying about that. And that kind of thing. But actually, when we said, what's your SEND provision here? Oh, you have to speak to the Senko?
Shouldn't have to.
Oh, okay. So,
doing such a bang up job, the Senko.
I asked specific questions.
You should be trained.
She was only part time as well, wasn't
she? Don't care.
And I said, okay. They didn't, as it happened, I think they had like one SEND child in the school, from what we were told. We saw this child and they were just constantly being taken out of lessons and, you know, which we agree with removing and having sensory breaks, but it didn't look like they were just ever engaging in anything.
It looked like he was having a great time.
He looked miserable,
Did he have some kind of bouncy ball?
Don't remember.
I think
probably.
He did. That was about it. The highlight of his day was probably bouncing that ball in that playground.
Yeah.
By himself with his one-to-one person.
But because I kept pressing about the SEND stuff, they kind of took us over to this table of people and asked the question. And they said, we do now in next boards.
Oh,
that was
great.
It. That was all they could tell us.
Fantastic.
That's all they could tell us. So we knew there and then it wasn't the right place. Went to another school that was in our catchment. And everyone has said, oh no, blah, blah, blah. And actually, they were amazing and have continued to try really hard for us and for our child. And they've worked with us.
Yeah.
But they have sadly got to a point where they've said, this brings us no joy to have to admit, but we cannot teach him. We cannot support him. And they gave him an unofficial part-time timetable, one-to-one, sensory and movement breaks, and anything that we basically suggested they implemented.
They were very receptive to whatever ideas we were putting across.
Anything we did at home that was successful, they tried to keep consistent at school.
Yes.
But the problem was it went beyond that. He was struggling to even get ready for school in the end. He was struggling to get there. He was struggling to come home. It was a fight. He was anxious all the time. He became really explosive. Reception year was not great, but was more bearable because they could be a bit more flexible. If he wanted to wear the superhero costume all day, they'd let him. But they got to a point in the year where they said, we need to like teach him now that he can't just have his own way. And as we've already discussed, he's not a neurotypical child. He hasn't developed in the same way. There are still some gaps in some of the development for him, particularly socially and emotionally.
Yes.
He's quite far behind. And because he's articulate and academically able, even though they didn't see that part of him, sadly, because of everything else being so overwhelming for him, that he didn't demonstrate anything to them, to be honest. But the problem is, again, you can't treat a child like him, like the children who can handle that stuff. And so what happened was the more they started putting demands on him and the more they started saying, no, you know, now is the point where we're not going to be flexible with you anymore. You are not having that freedom anymore. Where before we said you could spend an afternoon doing role play or going and doing whatever you wanted, that's being removed because they needed to prepare him for the next steps, which would be near year one. That's when things started to really quickly deteriorate. And then, of course, COVID.
Yep.
And at that point, we experienced some really, really shocking behaviour. It just started before lockdown. And then obviously it was just all a bit much and it was a huge escalation in his behaviour. Calmed down for a little while. And then I think when he went back into year one, I mean, literally within no time at all, within the first couple of weeks, they said, can we put him on a part-time timetable? Because he's not coping.
It was the only thing I will fault at them. Was communication could have been a bit better because it seemed out of nowhere. I mean, the only good thing is you even said, look, this is going to happen, this is going to happen.
Yes.
And you were right all the way through every single bit of the situation as it unfolded over the past couple of years. You predicted it would start a certain way and then it'll end up a different way.
Every single part of
so,
his life I've predicted so far.
So when they finally decided, you know, right, out of the blue in quotation, you're thinking, wow, you could have given us a bit more of a insight. They tried to deal with a lot of it in house, but
we found stuff in paperwork that we didn't know about.
Yeah.
That's... So we were like, whoa, this was happening as well. We didn't even realise it was that extreme.
Yeah.
And, but...
quite upsetting, to be honest. It was upsetting. Because you didn't realise how much of a challenge it was.
We cried a lot about some of the things. And also just imagining him in those scenarios.
Not having a good time.
Oh, horrible. Really horrible. And you've put him there.
You know,
that's horrendous.
You feel guilt.
But you're told you have to because we need eyes on him, because we need evidence, because they won't listen to just the parents. And it's really horrific when you put it that way, isn't it? You have to basically cause trauma to get any help. And even then it's not guaranteed. It's just insane. And then they want you to do more. Oh, it's just crazy. But yeah, I just remember when he first started school, everyone, I said I didn't think he was ready. And I think part of it for me was, okay, we need to get eyes on him. And I need to prove that it's not just me. I need to prove that he is actually going to struggle, because no one believed me. And everyone was like, oh, you're just being a fussy parent. You're just being an overbearing mum, blah, blah, blah. And for the first few weeks, everybody was on my case constantly. Is he coping all right? Is he doing all right? They all wanted to hear, oh, he's loving it. He's having a great time. Because it would mean that I was just exaggerating and I was wrong.
What they're really saying is, am I right? Are you wrong?
Yeah. Basically, you know, have you worried for nothing?
Because
that's all I've had from day one.
Fuck off.
And but year one was just, I think, the turning point, the breaking point, when he went into a setting that was obviously different because of COVID, but the setting was also very different for him because it's more structured and they expect a lot more of you and they don't have the flexibility. And they very quickly gave him a one-to-one and all the adaptations I've already told you about. And he couldn't even cope with that. So I got a call, and actually I think I'd said about trying a part-time timetable, hadn't I? And then I said, should I call the school and suggest it? And this was before I even knew how badly he was struggling. I just knew there was something not right because of his behaviour at home. And he'd become so explosive and violent, resistant.
Just extreme heightened emotion.
Very withdrawn, depressed. I would actually use that word. It was horrible. You know, at bedtimes, which is normally the time we'd have snuggles and kisses and stories, he just lay there vacant, staring into space, and occasionally you'd get things from him, but if you tried to press too far, he'd ask you to leave. And I'd cry every evening, and yeah, it was just absolutely horrific. What a horrible experience, and you just can't imagine. Well, we did, when we saw the paperwork, we then realised, okay, this makes more sense, because that hadn't been communicated to us. The reasoning was because they were trying to protect us from a lot of it. They didn't want to stress us out more because of everything we were already experiencing. But we said, in future, please notify us, because we need to be aware.
It's important.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that, I would say that covers a lot of the primary school scenario. So
it's just too much, isn't there, really?
I mean, that was a very abridged version. I think the last bit in here is probably submitting the EHCP and the responses and having to go through the rigmarole of that aspect in elective home education.
Okay, so basically, as I've already explained to you, we were refused an EHCP even to be supported by the SENCO, the area SENCO, when he was in preschool. For one reason or another, it never happened when he was in reception.
Yeah, thanks a bunch, by the way. Thanks.
And it ends up being me taking it over. We were actually advised to do it as parents, because apparently there's a higher rate of success if you're a parent. But we have actually checked with Sendias, and I've forgotten the other organisation. I don't know who it is, so I'm not going to name it. But we were advised by Sendias this is actually not true. Apparently schools and parents carry equal weight. But they said a parent normally only applies if the school is not in support of it. If a school is in support of it, really, it should be down to the school, because they have the statistics and the evidence that is required. So some of the stuff on there you cannot answer as a parent. And so actually, the actual thing I was advised was that the school should have done it, and it wasn't actually right for me to have applied. But saying that, I feel at this stage, this many years on and him struggling to the extent that he was.
Somebody to take the reins.
It was the right decision for me to take it over and have the control over it, really. But it was stressful. And I spent a couple of weeks intensely kind of, whenever I had a free moment, just trying to get this put together. And I can't even say it was done to the same level that I would have liked it done. I just had to do what I could do in the time I had available. And I was very drained from the children,
yeah,
to be honest with you. I think there were some repetitions in there and what have you. But as it happens, I was told, you know, it is likely to not be accepted and you'll have to go to appeal and all this kind of thing. And it was accepted. So I was actually really proud of that effort, to be honest with you.
I would have been very impressed if they rejected all that hard work. Let's face it, you could have diagnosed the kid based on your evidence. You could have done everyone's job for him.
This is what's frustrating, because if actually you could see the paperwork I have provided,
yeah,
to multiple agencies, and by agencies I mean like different people, organisations, you know, that's kind of what I mean by using that term.
We might redact it at some point and release it in a way, yeah, that means you could then use it, stuff.
Just lift stuff from it, because...
No copy and paste though, plagiarism.
Not plagiarism.
Yeah, and also if enough of you is doing it, then...
Then again, you could. You could put like our blog name at the bottom, like, you know, like copyright it.
Yeah, yeah.
And they can use that template, and then the local authorities get really pissed off at us for providing this, because they were going to get the blanket template with all these things.
You're welcome.
I'm tempted to do it, because so far everything, yeah, I've written has had some kind of impact. It's actually created some kind of change, and it's actually progressed us. You know, what can I say, really?
I believe there is room for a wizard, an on-rails way of guiding you through the process to help you construct all of this and to navigate through the minefield that is this whole process, yeah, including later on, once we've got enough experience ourselves, the budget and the type of things you can apply for,
yeah,
on that.
Yeah, because we're still doing all of, yeah, that now.
When we get to an advanced stage in all of this, we've experienced ourselves, maybe after the first year, I'm quite determined to build something to make everyone's life easier that have to do an EHCP. I think that's something that I'm interested in doing after I do a bunch of other stuff. My mind never stops. But yeah, from my perspective, I might put the feelers out, maybe some kind of poll to the community and see if there's enough demand for it. Because at the end of the day, I'm not going to build it for one person. No offense to that one person. It's just not worth my time. I want to help as many people as possible.
I think that's, you know, what's so frustrating is our blog, or blogs, because we've got a couple of them now, our blogs have never been designed to kind of, you know, again, we're anonymous for several reasons. The biggest reason is to protect the identity of the children. They have, yeah, not given permission. They obviously are not old enough to be even aware of what we're saying and doing, but they haven't given their permission. I don't really feel it's fair for me to kind of openly say, hey, this is me, this is my children, this is their whole life out there for everyone to see and know about. And like I've said, you know, people can find you if they really wanted to desperately find you, but mine's more about preserving the identity of the children.
It is, yeah.
It's not fair on them. It's not because I'm not proud, and it's not because I'm ashamed. I would love to put my face out there in some sense, but I'm also not the kind of person that wants to do webinars or, you know, live chats. It's just not comfortable for me. This is much easier. No one can see me. I can do whatever stims I need to do without, yeah, being judged. You know, it's that
I can
kind
look
of
like
thing.
Shit and just be them.
Precisely.
In my shorts.
Took my trousers off earlier because they were uncomfortable. I'm sat here in pants and a nightdress and, you know, well, not pants, knickers.
I don't want to be internet famous.
And I think that's the thing. Like, you know, people assume whenever you do these things that there's some kind of ulterior motive or you'd like to monetize from it. I think obviously if you have options to do this as a job, of course you'd jump at the chance.
To help more people, wouldn't you?
To help people. But our intention has always been about raising awareness, educating people, creating discussion and helping people. And we do help people where we can. But we don't have a huge following. And my frustration at that is because it is that we're not reaching enough people. And I've always said to you, what you need really is all these voices to collaborate. Instead, what happens is it seems that only the ones with the big followings all seem to collaborate. But what is really frustrating is you have voices like mine who are a lot smaller, and yet we're actually trying to do some real good in the community, like physically helping people with their paperwork and, you know, trying to demystify some of the terminology and the processes and
systematic change.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we want. We don't just want to talk about it. I don't just want to do a live chat and people ask me a few questions.
And I make money off it at the end.
It's just not, you know, that's not what the motive is. Yes, of course, I would love to be doing something in this field as a job because I want to see change, and I want to see change for our children. And there's nothing more to it than that, really.
100%. That's it. Literally that.
But I think people sadly judge you as, I mean, I've been accused of attention seeking and wanting to be like a celebrity. And it's just, that is the furthest thing from my mind. I do not want to be public. I hate the idea of having to go on television and doing interviews. That is not the kind of advocate I see myself as.
No.
It's more, I just want to put information out there and help families get the support they need. That really would make me happy, even if I've helped a handful of people, which even to this point I have. So...
Actually. So I'd say that.
I've already achieved what I wanted. But
exactly. Even if you change it for one person. Mine was different. It was about writing code for one person. That's a lot of effort. So we've covered that. And then I think we'll wrap up with, so you get the decision from the panel regarding the EHCP, and they'll hopefully, fingers crossed, issue it. If they don't issue it, you can appeal that decision. And you can also appeal what their recommendations are as well.
We probably need to give this its own bit of time, and this wouldn't be a big podcast. It's probably like a half an hour, but I think we need to probably talk about the EHCP on its own. But in short, you apply for it, you get told if your request has been accepted, and then you go over the finer points of targets and things that they feel might benefit the child. They decide whether or not they feel they can thrive in mainstream or whether they will qualify for a specialist place should one be available. You are not actually supposed to be involved in that process a great deal. They are the ones who decide where your child fits. And the situation we're in is we've been told clearly by the school they cannot meet his needs, and the school have made that very clear to the panel. We have made it very clear to the panel that he is not thriving at school. You know, and actually, like you said today, he's at school to learn and he's not learning there. They didn't even think he knew his phonics, and yet he's known those since before the age of two.
Please. Yeah.
So, but that's fine. You know, again, it's not a dig at the school. The fact is, how can they see what he can do when he is so overwhelmed by that environment?
Yes, it's not them. It's the environment and the rules and the structure of it. But the whole fact is,
at home, I'm doing some year two work with him in time, for example. At school, they don't think he can even count or access simple phonics.
That's so funny.
You know, they think he's a few book bands behind, lower than he actually is. It's that kind of thing. Because he doesn't demonstrate his ability because he's so overwhelmed and distracted with everything else that's going on there. And what really frustrated us, and I have so much more to say on this, is despite all of this evidence and despite the fact that it's very clear he is not thriving in that environment, it has been written into the EHCP that he could be supported in mainstream, but the parents have chosen to home educate. And it absolutely enraged us both. We were upset, we were enraged, we were hurt, we were confused. It's really obvious that he can't thrive. And they've said that because he currently doesn't have a formal diagnosis, he can't also even be considered for a specialist school. But that also because of the PDA element, there doesn't seem to be anywhere that actually could support him. But then on this EHCP, they write this comment about how he could actually be supported in a publicly funded primary school, which is complete nonsense. And we just didn't understand what their agenda was.
Theoretically, you could physically bring him to that building, and that's about it. I just find it hilarious because they would treat this like a science experiment. And your kid isn't going to have a good time. Nothing's going to change. You're
They're
just
not thinking about him as a person. It is just literally, you know, yeah, we can keep him in the school if we do this, this, this. But they've actually, but actually,
what's he actually gaining?
Exactly.
Is he actually able to access the work and thrive in that environment? No.
No.
Is he capable of much more? Yes.
Is he demonstrating that in a comfortable environment at home with his one-to-one qualified teacher mother? Yeah, he is.
Absolutely.
He's doing really well. It is, you know, why upset the formula at this stage? We're not saying that things might not change down the line, but currently he is at home. He is progressing. It's hard work. I will talk about that another day. It's hard work. But it's just the way they so flippantly kind of accused, you know, implied that it's just such a light decision for us to homeschool. Like, they just would rather keep him home, even though we've proved that he can thrive there. That is not what was said. And this is not a light decision. We're sacrificing an income. This is a huge commitment for me. It's draining. And I did challenge it. And we are in the process of challenging it. We're not happy.
It would be much easier just to bundle him off to school, fuck him up, get him to not learn anything, underachieve, build a complex, isolate himself from his peer group, grow up into adulthood really damaged, just so that we can have, you know, everything the way it should be according to them. And it's just not acceptable. We're in the fortunate position where we're not loaded or anything. I earn enough to keep it so that we can, you know, survive on one wage in the household, which then frees you up to be able to attend his needs. And it's hard enough with our situation, but there are people in way worse situations than ours. And we consider ourselves lucky.
Yeah. And also the fact is, there are some parents I've come across who've said, oh my gosh, it's taken us years to get to a point where we're actually now doing well with homeschooling.
Yeah.
And where I've got the privilege is that I'm a teacher. And not only am I just a teacher, I said this to you earlier, I get so fed up with being underestimated. I'm not just a teacher. I'm not bigging myself up. But the facts are, year upon year, I was given very challenging classes with a plethora of needs. And year upon year, I helped those children progress. I helped them belong in that classroom. I made them want to come into school. I empowered them. They were a part of their learning journey. I involved them as much as I could. I enthused them. I was in there with them. I was doing it with them. You know, we focused on progress, not on your end result, if that makes sense. You know, there were children in there who started at a level one, some who were on a level three, and you cannot expect all of them to get to a level four at the end of a year, for example. And some schools do have these ridiculous targets for children. Children are too aware of what levels and targets they should have been at the time.
And they shouldn't be aware.
And what I did was take that pressure away from them and always say to them, you know, it's on me and not you, and we're doing this together and blah, 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 blah. And year upon year, these children progressed. And at the moment, my son is progressing. And that's not a coincidence. And nobody is acknowledging my experience with these children and how I've had to research and provide resources and find ways to teach them by myself. No one's helped me do it. And so that really annoys me that they aren't listening to me, not just as an autistic person, not just as a parent, not just as a teacher, but a teacher who has done this time and time again, repeatedly, consistently got results. And I'm frustrated. I know what I'm talking about and I'm not listened to.
It's like you should write a book on this.
Yeah, I think I will. But again, it's the executive dysfunction. It's the time. I'm so exhausted. Like, sitting here talking is much easier than sitting with a laptop, isn't it?
That, I would say that's it for this episode. So on that note, it's goodbye from me.
And bye from me. Thanks for listening.